Welcome to Stories After Midnight. Today we'll be reading a story called The Murders on Lakeview Drive by Jared. It's a viewer-submitted story, so I really want to say thank you to Jared for sending this in to me. I really appreciate it. Now, let's get started. You feel that last bit of breath leaving the body. You're looking into their eyes. A person in that situation is God. Ted Bundy. Stalking. The year is 1972, and a man lurks outside 146 Lakeview Drive, a slice of suburban paradise nestled in the heart of California. It's an inviting townhouse, and despite the street name, does not overlook a lake. No one knows exactly why the street is named Lakeview Drive, but they pay it no mind since the neighborhood is safe and friendly and a perfect area to raise a family. Its porch hangs close to the ground due to its low sightline enables easy, undetected hiding. The man wears a striped, short-sleeve polo shirt and wrinkled blue jeans. Circular glasses hide his freckles and bushy red hair covers most of his ears. It's early in the evening, when the sky is a mix between navy, blue, and purple. The late autumn air is chilly with a hint of a breeze. He squats down out of sight in the tall bushes aligning the front yard, and raises his Polaroid camera to his face, staring in the front window through the viewfinder. White curtains partially obscure his view, and yellow light pours out in the panoramic glass from two tall living room lamps, shading the yard in a slight golden hue. The man in the bushes is the serial killer Neil Gillen. He breathes slowly in through his nose, out through his mouth. The birds overhead are strangely quiet, sensing the presence of a predatory animal. The chirping of crickets infuses the night with a familiar harmony. He watches a man sit in an orange plaid recliner in the corner of the living room reading a newspaper. The man leans back in the chair, nursing a cigarette. He's the father, the breadwinner, the man of the house. His dress shirt is unironed, and he looks stressed from work. Deep wrinkles are carved in his forehead, and his thinning hair suggests he is going bald prematurely. The wife walks in puffing a cigarette of her own. Her figure is younger than her years, and her tall, brunette updo is attractive. She goes jogging in the morning and shopping in the afternoon. Her outfit is a smorgasbord of conflicting color, a flower-dusted apron over a purple sweater and red corduroy slacks that brush against the floor. She normally wears platforms and buys pants with longer legs to accommodate the extra inches. She works harder than her husband and does so with a smile. She hands the man a plate of brown food, meatloaf. The man smiles in appreciation but doesn't actually want to eat it. The blandness is apparent from the first bite. He refills his glass of soda twice before finishing it. The younger son enters but doesn't eat. He sits down on the green leather sofa and begins reading a science fiction novel. He looks young, maybe 17, with acne splotches on his face. His hair is long and shaggy, and he wears disheveled pajamas. He's lazy and failing his classes. The arguments between him and his mother are loud enough to be heard from the sidewalk. The older daughter strolls in wearing a tight-fitting top and tighter belted jeans that flare around her ankles. The stain at the corner of her mouth suggests she's already eaten. She stomps at the television and bends over to turn it on. She has a curvy body, and the jeans accentuate it. Working the dial, the channels switch until it stops on something she wants to watch. Satisfied, she walks over to the same green leather sofa and sits down next to her brother. She crosses her legs and begins to watch, laughing intermittently. The brother gets annoyed and angrily gets up and goes down to his room in the basement. The family relaxes, the wife finishing frosting a pan of cupcakes, cleans the kitchen, and then happily sheds her apron and heads into the living room. Once the man has finished his dinner, he fills out the crossword on the back of the newspaper, routinely asking his wife and daughter for words he does not know. After half an hour, he rises and folds up the paper and hands it to his wife, who skims it briefly before also rising. She follows him upstairs where they shower together, undoubtedly the highlight of their night. The daughter continues to sit there and watch television. Neil can't help himself. He stands up out of the bush, the sky now pitch black, and creeps up slowly to the front window. He peers through the glass, his mouth watering, and checking to make sure his flash is off, begins snapping photos of the girl. He feels himself stirring, but exercises restraint. He'll have to develop these pictures later. The daughter rubs her upper arms, a restless look on her face. Neil takes this as a sign and retreats back to his hiding spot. Inside the house, Laura Hughes senses something amiss. She stands up from the sofa, walks over to the window, and peers outside. She puts her hand over her forehead to block out the glare and skims the front yard. She can't see anything, but feels like she's being watched. Her shoulders convulse back and forth as a chill sprints down her back. "What you doing, honey?" Laura jumps at the sound of her mother's voice. She turns and sees Karen Hughes in a nightgown, a light, silky purple that drags on the carpeted floor. "Oh, nothing, sorry." Laura looks down at the floor. "Why are you staring out the window?" Karen asks. Laura shrugs. "I don't know." "Don't know?" Karen shuffles into the laundry room and puts a load of darks into the washing machine. The spinning hum blends in with the sound of the television. When she returns, Laura speaks. "I felt like there was someone outside watching me." Karen stops walking and looks at her daughter with a concerned expression. "Watching you?" Karen asks, putting a hand on Laura's shoulder. Laura nods. "Did you see anything?" Karen cranes her neck to look. Laura shakes her head. "No, but I just feel creeped out." Laura's bottom lip twists into a frown. Karen walks over to the front door, but Laura jumps in front of her and tugs on her arm. "No, don't go out there!" Laura shouts it louder than she means to. Karen looks at her daughter, her eyes wide. "What on earth are you talking about?" She reaches for the doorknob, but Laura jumps in front of her again, blocking the door with her body. "Laura, my goodness, what has gotten into you?" Karen asks. I don't know. I just feel off. "Don't be ridiculous. We live in one of the safest neighborhoods in the entire state." Karen pushes past her daughter and peeks through the sidelight glass bordering the door. She cups her hands over her eyes and looks out as a gust of wind blows leaves off the front porch. She turns slightly as she surveys the driveway with the Cadillac Eldorado, her car, and the Oldsmobile Cutlass, her husband's. She sees nothing. Everything is still. She straightens and looks at Laura, softening her tone. "Honey, I can tell that you're afraid, but there's nothing out there. Look, I'll show you." Karen reaches for the doorknob and turns it. She is about to open the door, but can tell that Laura is terrified. She is biting her fingernails and tapping her feet anxiously on the floor. Just then, the husband, Tom Hughes, descends the stairs. He looks up and smiles at them. The smile vanishes as soon as it spreads. He can tell something is off. He finds it odd that they're standing in the foyer. "Is something wrong?" Tom asks his wife. Her eyes gesture over to Laura, who is trembling. He gives her a confused look. "What's going on?" he asks. "Well, tell your father." Karen pries at Laura and she shakes her head, her cheeks reddening in embarrassment. Karen folds her arms and leans back against the door. "Tell me what?" "Go on, tell your father." "No, it's stupid." She starts to walk away, but Karen reaches out and grabs her shoulder, guiding her back. "She's scared, Tom." Karen's voice is intense and unwavering. "About what?" He looks troubled.
"I thought someone was watching me," she squeaks out.
"From outside?" Tom asks. Laura nods almost imperceptibly. Karen shoots Tom a look and mouths an "I don't know" with her lips. "I'll go check," Tom says with a sigh. Laura tries to stop him, but she knows she isn't going to be able to. Karen was easier to stop, but Tom will not sleep until his daughter feels safe. He pushes past the two women without bothering to put on shoes and opens the front door. He walks down the steps of the porch and onto the path that cuts through the yard and leads to the driveway. He looks the way a man might if he's doing an unwanted task at work. He glances around but doesn't examine. Had he, he would have seen the footprints in the grass and the disturbed leaves and would have dialed 911. Neil Gillen would have been arrested for trespassing. But Tom Hughes doesn't pay too close attention because he doesn't believe his daughter in the first place. She's always been antsy and a bit high-strung. And so, with his wife and daughter looking on through the threshold of the front door, Tom declares the yard safe and secure. "There's nothing out here. I'm coming back in."
He blows out a breath and rubs his hands together as Karen shuts the door behind him. "Feel better?" she asks Laura. Laura shrugs. "I guess so." Karen scoffs. "Guess so? What do you mean? Your father just went out there for you, I might add, and saw nothing out of the ordinary. You need to get over..." Karen gestures up and down with her arms outstretched and wiggles her hands. "Whatever this is." "Okay. Sorry, Mom." Laura's head sags and Karen can sense that she is still bothered. Determined to not let Laura's sulking ruin her night, Karen enters the living room and seats herself on the sofa in the same spot Laura had been. The leather is still warm and cradles her more snugly than it otherwise would have. She watches Johnny Carson with her husband. Both of them find the chimpanzee skit hilarious. Laura can hear her parents having a great time in the other room, and the nonchalant dismissal of her feelings bothers her. The way her mother blew up at her hurts, and she feels like crying to herself. Her fear still floats around her brain, so she walks upstairs to the bathroom and soaks in a long, hot bath. Down in the basement, Bradley Hughes is unaware of what has transpired upstairs. His bedroom window is propped open, allowing a cool breeze to glide into his room. The window is at ground level and he can smell the backyard grass. He is immersed in that same science fiction novel when he hears a peculiar sound from outside. He hears a dried twig snap in half and the rustle of crinkled leaves. He looks up from his book. The night is enveloping, and he can't see anything. He tells himself it's an animal, maybe a raccoon. The sound leaves his mind as soon as it enters. After another 20 minutes of quiet reading, he places his bookmark in his book, sets it on his nightstand, and flicks off his lamp. He leaves the window open and enjoys the fresh air. He falls asleep. Back upstairs, Laura dries off from her bath with a plush towel, drains the dirty tub water, and slips into pajamas. Still paranoid, she quietly walks down the long, dark hall to her bedroom. She shuts the door and crawls into bed. She tosses and turns, unable to sleep. Invasion. The personification of death kneels in the far corner of the backyard, obscured by the shadows of a drooping juniper tree. He gazes into the dark bedroom window through his Polaroid's viewfinder. The needle-like foliage cuts through the lens, but he can still watch the boy sleeping in his bed. He slips off his shoes, not wanting to break any more branches. He needs to remain silent for what he is about to do. In a barefoot crouch, he creeps past the covered swimming pool, over to the battered red work shed across the yard, and parts the unlocked door. He thinks about all the times he's taken a swim in that pool late at night, as the shed door swings out. His gaze falls upon landscaping equipment. A lawnmower sits in the center of the shed, the clipping bag crudely held together by duct tape. A weed whacker is strung up on the wall, dangling from a metal hook that is driven through the hole in the handle. An old metal toolbox is stationed against the far corner, and Neil squeezes past the mower to examine its contents, the wood panels creaking with each step. He pulls the cord to a single light bulb and rummages through the drawers, the metal side panels screeching against the frame. He finds nothing of use except for a straight razor that he slides into his pocket. Strange that a razor might end up in a toolbox, but he figures it might be an heirloom. He opens the blade and runs his finger along the edge. An almost imperceptible nick forms along his finger. It's wickedly sharp. He closes the drawer and examines an old, faded photo that has slid into one of the metal creases where the weld has failed. It's a man on a boat with his son. They're both smiling at the camera, and the boy holds a trout in his arms. They're both younger, but there is no mistaking who they are. Neil flips the picture around. It reads, Lake Tahoe, 1961. As he's ready to leave, he notices pool supplies strung about. He spots a chlorine solution sitting next to an ammonia-based tile cleaner. A curious thought runs through his head, and he mixes the two in a small container and swishes the toxic mixture. The fumes hurt his head, so he covers his nose and mouth with his shirt. He holds out his left hand, palm down, and without so much as a flinch, pours two drops of the concoction onto his knuckles. The skin bubbles and the pain registers, but he stares silently at the dissolving, peeling flesh. He's in control and can do whatever he wants. In the uppermost level of the house, Laura peels sweaty bedsheets off herself and basks in the cool air. her lava lamp casting her room in an atmospheric glow. She is thirsty, so grabs her water cup and starts making her way to the bedroom door. She opens it. The unoiled hinges cry out and squeak. She peers out into the hallway, the darkness consuming. Although she tries to deny it, she is still frightened. The feverish paranoia has subsided, but in the back corner of her brain, she's still on high alert for any sign of danger. She looks to the left and into the bedroom. Blackness. She looks to the right and down the hall to the staircase. Blackness. Why does she still sense a prowling threat? Wearily, and with her head on a swivel, she makes her way down the hall, feeling the wall with her fingers for guidance. Her eyes still haven't adjusted, and she doesn't want to stub her toe or run into anything. She gingerly descends the stairs to the ground floor and makes her way into the kitchen. Once there, she goes to the sink and turns on the tap. Water flows out and she fills her cup to the brim. She puts the cup to her lips and takes long gulps, downing all of it. Wiping her mouth with her sleeve, she begins to refill the cup and gazes out the kitchen window overlooking the backyard. Her heart stops beating from what she sees. The shed light beams out through the open door, highlighting the mower inside. A faint figure can be seen in the back. She is certain that no one in her family has gone back there tonight. She can faintly hear her parents snoring in the master bedroom, and she knows for a fact her brother is down in his room. There is no one who should be out there. Laura's hand shakes uncontrollably as she fumbles for the faucet. She drops her cup in the sink and it crashes down. Water spills out and tumbles over the sides, splashing the surrounding countertop and leaving puddles on the floor. Her footsteps echo throughout the house as she sprints down the hallway to her parents' bedroom. They leave the door slightly propped open and Laura pushes through it. The knob slams against the wall with a bang, and this causes them to stir. "Dad! Dad, wake up!" Laura shouts. She hears rustling and groaning. Her parents sit up and rub their eyes groggily. She sees her mother in her nightgown and her father in boxer shorts with his hairy chest exposed. When she doesn't think they're moving fast enough, Laura continues her panicked outburst. "Mom! Mom, I saw something outside!"
"What the hell, Laura?" Tom asks.
"What is the meaning of this? Do you have any idea what time it is?" Karen runs a hand over her face and scoots back against her pillow, her palms outstretched in disbelief. She demands an explanation and berates Laura for waking her father, who has to get up early for work in the morning. Laura waits for her turn to speak, and when she does, it's so fast and disoriented that her parents have to tell her to slow down.
I was getting a drink from the kitchen and I saw something in the backyard."
She is panting and out of breath. She rubs her sweaty palms down the front of her pajama pants to dry them.
"Oh, God, not this again. Damn it, Laura, it's 3 a.m.
Karen snaps.
"You have to believe me,"
Lauren pleads. "Get out," Tom shouts, frustration boiling out of him.
"No, Dad, please. There was someone."
"No, there wasn't. Out now."
He points and motions her out the door.
"The shed. The light was on in the shed,"
she spits out. Her parents pause and both give her a puzzled look.
"The shed?"
Karen asks. Laura nods.
"I'm getting real sick of this," Tom bemoans.
"I'm telling you."
Laura fidgets. She's a bundle of nerves.
"Just go and check real quick,"
Karen urges her husband.
"No,
I already went out there and there was nothing, not a damn thing out there."
"Do it for me."
Karen rubs his back tenderly. Tom grumbles and angrily shoves his arms in his nightrobe. He flies past Laura and she follows him into the kitchen. They reach the window and Tom looks out. Laura peeks over his shoulder and her stomach drops. The shed is pitch black, the door closed.
"No, it was on, I swear."
Her father turns back and gives her a long, hard look. A glare so full of annoyance and hostility that Laura feels her bladder threaten to release. She can feel herself melting down into the floor. She looks like a fool, a crazy, stupid girl. Without a word, he stomps past her back to the master bedroom, his aggravated footsteps rattling picture frames on the hallway wall, and slams the door shut. The lock ticks to dissuade any further disruptions. Murder. Neil wipes the blood off the straight razor and onto the sheets of Bradley's bed. He surprises himself at how silent and efficient he is at this. He feels alive the way a skydiver does after jumping out of a plane. He feels a laugh bubble up in his chest, and he smiles to himself to suppress it. He stares down at the dead boy with his slit throat, the cut perfectly straight. He didn't even struggle. Neil relished the look in the boy's eyes as the blade sliced open his Adam's apple. The shock on his face as he was immediately yanked out of sleep, the wide eyes and the agonized pain, the instantaneous realization, the way he gurgled and coughed, the way the oxygen mixed with the blood, forming air bubbles that pushed past the gash in his neck. It looked like foam, like crimson soap lather. What really excited Neil was the boy's denial of his fate, the futile prolonging of a life already gone. He even tried to stomp the bleeding with his hands. If he had been eating a meal, he would have been given the Heimlich. Neil loves this, so he picks up his camera, centers the bloody face in the viewfinder, and presses the button. The flash is on, and it alights the room in a blaze of white. A fitting color for a corpse. He wonders if the family is religious. Neil is straddling the boy, thus has to lift his leg up and over the corpse to stand back on the ground. He smooths out the wrinkles in his shirt and tucks it back into his jeans. He hates looking disheveled. His father always hated a sloppy appearance, and would beat him if his clothes were messy or out of place. It was worse if he was drunk. Some are fun drunks. Some are obnoxious drunks. Some are pathetic drunks, and some are violent drunks. He was the latter. Neil remembers the worst time. He's 11 and his father comes home late and beats his mom for no other reason than she's there. He sees Neil cowering over by the recliner and this enrages him. A couple of fists give him a puffy black eye, yet he doesn't cry. He's built up a high pain tolerance. This only pisses the old bastard off more, so he grabs his double-barrel shotgun and squats down next to Neil. He shoves the end into Neil's mouth. He cranes his head and asks Neil to feel until he reaches the trigger. Neil does and finds it. "Pull it," he says, his lips in a cold, hard line. "Go on, do it. Make my damn day, you waste of goddamn space. Pull it, you little bastard." Neil doesn't. The old man shouts at him, revealing brown, jagged teeth. A lifetime of chew and cigarettes. His breath is gag-inducing. A toothbrush might as well have been a foreign object to him. "Damn coward. Take after your mother, do ya?" He pulls the trigger for him. A dull click as the hammer strikes nothing. The barrel lacks the shells that usually fill him. "You damn lucky I went hunting, boy." The shotgun is dripping with saliva as it's retched from his mouth. He raises the butt of the gun and brings it down on Neil's head. He never felt the same after that. He found that his thoughts never flowed the same way. He never thought anything positive and he couldn't remember how to talk to other kids. They bullied him relentlessly, especially after the night his father killed his mother. He was then thrust into foster care. Neil remembers hungry nights, wishing for his dad to get released from prison, then maybe he could get some real food. He always brought home kills from his hunts. When Neil was 16, he got news that his father fried in the electric chair and remembers how conflicted he felt about it. Initially, he cried over it, and then the next day would laugh like a man who has just won the lottery. As time went on and he got older, he began to celebrate the anniversary with a cake and candles. By then, however, his brain had deteriorated further. He came to the conclusion that whatever they did to him in that execution chamber didn't hurt the son of a bitch enough. He wished the executioners wouldn't have put a sponge on the old man's head. That way, his hair could have caught on fire and he could have burnt alive to a crisp. Neil's first kill was on a Christmas day, 1968, a local prostitute. She was a crackhead that he paid with the promise of cocaine. He didn't even have any, but held up a bag spritzed with flour and she fell for it, hook and line and sinker. She put up a fight, but Neil found that strangling her and watching the light flicker out of her eyes was so enjoyable that he wanted to keep doing it. He remembers feeling her larynx give way. He got off her and watched her flop around like a fish out of water, gagging and gasping for air. She suffocated on her own bone fragments. He felt important, powerful, and for the first time in his life, in control. His second kill was a waitress a month after the first. He had watched her for a few weeks and knew her walk home was a long one. Her routine never changed. The click of her high heels made her so easy to follow and such an easy target. After all, she couldn't run when she was trying to balance. He caught her in a dark corner behind a building, and he hit her over the head with a broken socket wrench he had found in a pile of garbage. She didn't lose consciousness right away, and he got a great deal of satisfaction watching her squirm around on the ground with her arms and legs all stiff and awkward. Her face was buried in the concrete, and she gave him a muffled plea about how she had kids and to just take her purse. What a lovely sound. A second blow to the base of the skull finished her. Neil was careful and meticulous in his planning, preferring motel rooms or dark alleys with little to no foot traffic. The closest thing he ever got to a witness was a dumpster diving rat. He didn't discriminate, killing anyone, man or woman, young or old. It didn't matter to him. His crimes made the newspaper, but only the tiny blurb paragraphs on the side of the page that no one really bothered to read. The police had no evidence to go on since he picked his victims at random and struck in secluded areas. He took photos of his deeds and kept them as mementos. He hung them around the places he could study and examine them whenever he felt the urge. When he stumbled upon the Hughes residence in July 1972, he was already 6 in and had no intention of stopping. The young girl had caught his attention, picking weeds in the front yard with her mother. She was the most gorgeous girl he'd ever seen, and so he started watching the house. The house had large bushes that he could easily hide in. For months he observed, waited, listened, and planned. Always at night, never during the day. Sometimes he would hide in the cars that they never bothered to lock. He preferred the wife's Cadillac for how roomy it was and how plush the velvet seats were. Other times when he was bored, he would skinny dip in their backyard pool. He felt attached to the family and found himself shocked at how happy they were. It pissed him off seeing something he never had. And so, as he stands over Bradley's body, he feels that familiar rage course through his veins. He takes the straight razor and begins to hack away at the corpse, spraying blood on the wall and ceiling like some kind of repulsive art piece. He's unhinged, swinging the blade again and again until everything is red. Bits of flesh slowly slide down the wall and plop into the shag carpet. His arm starts to ache, so he calms himself and folds up the razor. Neil leans against the nightstand and picks up the paperback the boy had been reading just hours before. The cover is too soaked in blood to be legible. He shoves the book into his back pocket. A memento. He slinks up both flights of carpeted stairs without a sound and stands in the shadowless hallway. To his right, he can hear the parents talk about their beautiful daughter. She'll be his soon enough. She just doesn't know it yet. He slows his breathing to the bare minimum, treating each breath as if it's expensive. On his tiptoes, he creeps down the hall and stands outside the master bedroom. The most horrific of crimes are always calculated and preceded by stealth. This was the calm before the storm, the coiling of the venomous snake before it bites, the last moments of life before death. Massacre. 146 Lakeview Drive was one of those large houses that was virtually soundproof. The walls were thick and well insulated in spite of the brutally hot summers. For this reason, Karen and Tom have not heard the atrocity that has just been committed in their basement, two floors down. In fact, they are completely oblivious. They trade concerned thoughts about their daughter whilst lying in bed. "What's up with her?" Karen asks in a hushed tone. Tom sighs. "I don't know. Have you ever seen her act like this?" Her hands rise and fall in her lap despondently. Tom shakes his head. "No. Never."
"Neither have I. Just..."
She trails off and crosses her arms and looks down at the floor. "Just what?"
"What if she's telling the truth?"
"Oh, come on. You don't. Why would she make that up?" Karen looks at him. "I don't know. Maybe she's looking for attention."
"Attention? That's an odd way to seek attention, don't you think?"
The door bursts open, wood splinters showering the room. Karen lets out an earth-shattering shriek as a silhouette stands in the doorway. A clear liquid is thrown and lands in Tom's blinded eyes, the chlorine-ammonia mixture. Across the hall, Laura hears her mother scream so loud it rings off the walls. She's frozen. She tries to move, to run away, to do anything her brain is screaming at her to do. She can't. In the back of her mind, she realizes that she was right all along. Yet this one is primal, a barbaric, wicked howl that is full of hellish agony. Panicked, Laura flies out of bed but isn't sure what to do. Run? Help her parents? What? Oh, hell, what?
Hide. She needs to hide. She can't escape a man like that. She's had asthma since she was a little girl and wishes she had her inhaler right now. She feels a panic attack coming on and her lungs constrict. She spins in a circle, her breathing so rapid it's like machine gun fire. Where? In the closet? No, he'll find her by rustling around a few hangers. The bed is her only option. She gets down on her hands and knees and wiggles herself under the bed with her feet towards the headboard. She's flat on her stomach and she lets out a whimper. She hears flesh getting sliced. Her father cries out again and again, but is drowned out by her mother, who is screeching louder than Laura can stand. It's fear in its purest form. The grief, the shock, the hopelessness. The bed skirts cover her and she intuitively knows that her survival depends on stillness.
Tom, no!
An awful sound. She doesn't recognize it as her mother. She hadn't the faintest inkling a human could make such a wail. A sob builds up in her chest, but she holds it back. No, not now. She can't let him know where she is. She hears the clattering of furniture, the rattling of a dresser being forced into the wall, a cry of pain. A tear forms in her eye as impotence grips her. She can't help her mother. She hears the slap of feet on the floor as they approach her bedroom door.
No, don't hurt my son or daughter!
Karen screams, her voice raw and heart empty. Laura can hear her drag herself on the floor. She clutches his ankle with her hands, trying to pull him back and away from Laura's bedroom door.
Kill me! Don't hurt her! She's my everything! Please! Please!
The words morph into sobs. A whimpering, undulating beg that tears at Laura's heart.
No, she's not in there! Please, God, I'm begging you!
Karen's plea is cut off abruptly.
Shut up! Shut the hell up!
The intruder, his voice is immature and raspy like an angry teenager trying to act older than he is. Laura can hear him crawl on top of her. She hears the slaps as she tries to fend him off. The screams and the clawing, the scratching, the desperation. Not just for her, but her child. The very reason she is on this earth. To protect her baby. She puts up a valiant effort, and Laura cries into the carpet as she hears her mother fight for her dying breath. She bites him, for Laura can hear one of his fingers snap like a carrot. She gouges at his eyes, for she can hear the gelatinous eyeball pop in its socket. But it isn't enough. As Neil Gillen wraps his bloody hands around Karen Hughes's neck, he looks into her eyes and spots something unusual. Not fear for her own life. A resignation has seeped into Karen, yet she fights for her child, not herself. Neil has never seen a person die for someone else before, and this infuriates him. He isn't in control. She doesn't sufficiently fear him, doesn't care enough for her own life to satiate Neil's murderous appetite. So he squeezes. She coughs and sputters and rams her long, jagged fingernails into his groin. He cries out and she makes a fist and twists. He loosens his grip, but only momentarily. He is bigger and stronger, and she just doesn't have the strength left in herself to fight him. She feels herself weakening, her vision losing focus. With every ounce of willpower left in her soul, she croaks out, "Laura, I love you." Laura hears Neil stand up, the footsteps stopping right outside her bedroom door. The knob turns and he enters. She can see the bare toes dig into the carpet. The lights flick on. Laura lays with her chin to the floor. She can see the cuffs on his bloody blue jeans as he surveys the room. He sees a bed unmade. He knows she is hiding. He hears her whimpered cries and laughs because she's trying to muffle it with her hand. He sees her cute little feet and tickles them with his hands. She recoils in fear. She thinks that maybe if she can hide under the bed, get further under the frame, that he won't be able to reach her. She is sobbing now, not just at her attacker, but for the loss of her family. She doesn't know what they look like, but she knows it's not something she wants to see. Neil reaches under the bed and grabs her ankles. Laura screams and holds onto the bedposts for dear life. Her grip is no match for his pull, and she is wrenched free and out from underneath the bed. She kicks and bucks and claws like her mother moments before. Neil chuckles to himself. She isn't half as tenacious as her mother, probably because she has nothing to live for. The thought of strangling her flashes through his mind, but he can't bring himself to kill her in such a manner. She deserves better than her mother.
Her dignity must be preserved. He picks up her flailing body and hauls her over his shoulder, carrying her to the bathroom. He turns on the faucet to the tub. Water begins pouring out of the nozzle and he plops her down on the ground. She is shrieking.
Help! Please help me! Someone!
She wrestles with his lean, veiny hands as he pins her arms behind her back.
No, no! Please stop! You don't have to do this!
Her cheeks are red and burning hot from the crying. He doesn't speak, but he feels a twinge of guilt in killing this girl. Why? Her mother. The way she fought for her. It bothers him. Makes him uncomfortable just thinking about it. For some reason, he can't look into her eyes, so he forcibly shoves her head down past the lip of the tub and into the running water. Icy cold washes over her face. She arches her back, but isn't strong enough to fight him. Her long hair becomes soaked and clings to her back. She's able to pull her head away for brief moments to catch her breath, taking long, open-mouthed gulps. He tightens the grip on the back of her head, that familiar sense of dominance washing over his being. But this time, it feels different. Wrong.
Mommy! She wails. Mommy, help me!
Her organs are failing, but she hangs on as long as she can. Laura slumps after a long, prolonged battle. He snaps a photo. And then, as he looks down at her lifeless body, a deep-rooted sadness overcomes him. He leans down and blows a breath in her mouth. He doesn't know CPR, but he's trying to save himself. He starts to cry and he pumps her chest. He beats on her heart, hearing rib bones splinter. Clear water trickles hopelessly from her blue-tinged lips. She can't be resuscitated, he screams. Neil Gillen's massacre is complete. Aftermath. A patrol officer performing a routine welfare check found all four bodies of the Hughes family 2 days later, after Tom failed to show up for work. Neil Gillen was arrested outside a New Mexico bar in December 1976 for the unrelated murder of a college boy inside his dorm room. He was extradited back to California to stand trial for the murder of the Hughes family when his fingerprints taken from the dorm room matched the ones taken from the Hughes residence. He was found guilty after less than 2 hours of jury deliberation and sentenced to death. At the end of his 8-year reign of terror, he amassed 14 murders, confessing to all of them in an interview in 1979. When asked for the motive for his killing spree, his answer was simple. You never own a person, do you? Not in modern society, anyways. I feel I need to control the things around me, to influence them. To know that you, and you alone, have the power to spare or to take someone's life. There's something profound in that. When asked what his hardest kill was, he answered without hesitation. The blonde girl in that house several years ago. Laura Hughes? The interviewer asked. Oh, is that her name? I had no idea. Blonde hair? A nod. Then, yeah, it was her. Why her? Why was she so hard for you?
I don't know exactly. The first time I saw her, I knew she was different. I never wanted someone in that way before, but the more I watched her, the more resentful I became. She had everything I wanted, and then I did it, and I couldn't even look her in the eyes. When I realized what I had done, I tried to save her. I don't know what I was thinking. Her picture was the only one I burned. I couldn't keep it. Couldn't look at her. I was a coward. I'd never felt bad for someone until then. I kill nobodies, people that don't matter. That one was my one and only family. I never went into a house again after that. The way her mother fought me, the way she defended her, just knowing that she mattered to someone, it struck me as odd. A very odd thing that I can't explain.
In an ironic twist of fate that somewhat mirrored the fate of his father, he was executed via the gas chamber in San Quentin State Penitentiary in June 1983. A journalist from the LA Times said of the experience, "He was strapped down in a wire mesh chair. They sealed him in the chamber and then dropped the cyanide pellets. The gas flowed in around him and he looked scared. He foamed out the mouth and vomited multiple times. It took him a half hour to finally succumb." Karen Hughes's younger sister Gwen was present at the execution. Of this, she stated, "I only wished he would have suffered longer for what he did. What he did to my sister Karen, her husband Tom, and my lovely niece Laura and nephew Bradley. It's been 11 years and I still think about them every day.
And then she turned away from the cameras, not wanting to weep on television nor confront the angry protesters outside the prison's gates. She was not the only one to think about the Hughes family. Over 1,000 people showed up for their funerals. The church wasn't large enough to accommodate everyone, thus a second memorial service was held so all who wanted to pay their respects could. Their presence in their community was felt long after they were gone. Perhaps somewhere up in the sky they found peace. Maybe a little corner of the universe ridden of hate and violence and pain. 50-odd years later, flowers still regularly line their headstones. Neil Gillon was buried in an unmarked plot in the San Quentin Prison Cemetery known as Boot Hill. No one claimed his body, and no one showed up to his burial aside from the gravediggers. The weeds have long since covered his headstone. And that's the end of the story. I really hope you enjoyed it. What a freaking crazy one that was, wasn't it? If you did and you're on YouTube, I'd love it if you'd like the video and leave a comment letting me know your thoughts, because the YouTube algorithm should, you know, show this to more people, and so we gotta try and coerce it to do that. I really appreciate you for listening. A huge shout out to my patrons for helping make this episode possible. I know I say that all the time, but I could never say it enough just how much it means to me. If you'd like to, and you don't have anything better to do, you can come join our Discord and say hello. It'd be nice to see you and, you know, hang out and chat. It's a pretty cool place, got some nice people there. And if you'd like to send in your story, head over to storiesaftermidnight.com, where there will be a link to do just that. With all that said, thank you for listening. We'll see you in the next one.